So good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to Open Tech, which is delightfully sponsored by the Open Tech Institute. Thank you very much. This is the first session for the Open Rights Group panel, which we'll hear more about in a few minutes. We've got a very distinguished panel here today, including several people who founded it, as well as some of you guys. So, bit of a thing. Open Tech is now 10 years old, and incidentally, so is the Open Rights Group. 10 years ago, we founded, we being quite a lot of people at the same time, founded an organisation, the Open Rights Group, because we felt that there wasn't enough being done in the protection of digital civil freedoms. We joined from a variety of things, and through the crowdsource website, PledgeBank, which was built by My Society, lots of people, 1,000 or so people, pledged to commit a fiver a month to help keep the org going. I'm delighted to say that there is still the case that people do actually cough up a fiver a month to help kickstart this sort of thing. Some do more, some do about that. But it's great that we've got an organisation that's funded by the people that has that transparency, as well as through other work, I have to add. And we've got a very decent panel here today. So, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Wendy Grossman. I'm a freelance... I have a slide that says all this. I'm Wendy Grossman. I'm a freelance writer. And to my right is Jim Killick, who is the current executive director of the Open Rights Group. And Sue Charman Anderson, who is, it says here, a social technologist, founder of Ada Lovelace Day, and the first executive director of Open Rights Group. And to her right is Luis Ferguson, user interface consultant.
When was that written?
I don't know. This is what the Open Rights Group people gave me.
This is probably what's on the website.
Whatever.
And the first chair of Open Rights Group. Well... if you can see this, this is my prepared picture of 2005 Open Tech, the panel at which Open Rights Group was founded, and left to right are Ian Brown, Rufus Pollack, Dan O'Brien, and Cory Doctorow, and they ran this panel discussing why there wasn't a UK version of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And it was actually kind of a reasonable question, because in my second slide... there's a list of all sorts of precursor organizations that had sort of existed. 1985, GreenNet was doing interesting things for connecting environmental activists around the world. Privacy International was founded in 1990.
It's behind.
Ah! You've got it.
Can we just make it bigger? Privacy International was founded. Great.
Next slide.
You guys are brilliant. Where is the I had the remote a minute ago.
This remote. This remote.
Okay, so there is your very fuzzy picture from YouTube.
That won't this very room.
This won't work? That.
I think it was downstairs.
Why didn't someone invent screws for these things? Oh, yeah. They did.
It's coffee. It's a question of coffee.
Right, look at that. So we'll just play a minute for the projector to grow.
Yeah. 1995, Wired began publishing a UK edition. I am very proud of the piece I wrote for it. At 1997, NTK. How many people remember NTK?
Yay!
I believe if you go to their website, you can actually see the issue that would have been published 10 years ago today. 1998, Foundation for Information Policy Research. 2002, the European Digital Rights Initiative, or whatever. There we go. Now you can do your own reading, which I'm sure you're good at. So what I remember is I was not at Open Tech that year, or I missed the panel, but I heard about it. And by the beginning of the panel, apparently from there's a great blog posting that Dan O'Brien has at his Oblomovka blog, where he tells the story of the panel and says that he started out very dubious, and by the end of the panel, a bunch of people had promised to pay £5 a month to join this organization that didn't exist yet. And as I understand it, Sue Charman was, as she was then, was a big part of this whole thing. What I remember is hearing about the panel, emailing Danny and saying, how do I become a leading light of the Open Rights Group? A question which, by the way, was never really answered. And a month later, I found myself meeting Sue in a tube station somewhere as she started to explain to me how she was going to bootstrap this thing. So I'm going to hand it to, I'm going to ask Sue to tell us the early history of org, which is locked up in your mind, which no one else
where
knows.
I should stay. Are we using the mic or am I just going to shout?
No, I think
they'll
record.
Are you recording? Okay. I will stand. Basically, the way that I remember it, and it is 10 years ago and it is a little fuzzy, I'd started talking to Danny O'Brien around the data retention directive in Europe, probably sort of early 2005. And so turned up to Open Tech already sort of primed for, you know, something must be done and maybe someone will do something. The panel itself was really interesting. And I remember asking a few pointed questions about how we could get our view into the media, because when you looked at the coverage of digital rights issues, you know, whether that was data retention or whether that was copyright or whether that was e-voting or at the time sort of things like DRM, the press line tended to be the corporate or the government line. There wasn't a countervailing voice that journalists could quote. So my whole sort of thing was like, look, you know, let's get in front of the media and use the media to extend our voice and to reach more people. So after the panel, there was a sort of very hurried huddle as Danny O'Brien scribbled a pledge on Pledge Bank saying, you know, I will do this thing if 1,000 other people will pledge £5. And I think the £5 figure came from someone in the audience. Was it Steve Coast, I think?
Yes, that's
who
what
basically
the
stood up at the
says.
End and kind of went, enough chit-chat, I will pledge money if other people will. So Danny put this pledge together. It immediately kind of hit the BBC, and we had such a response. I think we didn't quite know what to do with ourselves. It all went a little bit crazy pretty much immediately, because the media were obviously have a good eye for a good story. So there was already a group, as Adam's mentioned, there were groups like Stand and Privacy International, and there were people like Steph Magdalinsky, who'd been working on Fax My MP, or Fax Your MP. And so there was already a number of people who knew how to lobby, how to get in front of journalists, how to do all of this stuff. And then there was sort of me coming along kind of going, oh, well, you know, what I do is organise stuff, and ended up being the de facto organiser of stuff. Brought in Louise as a chair for a bit of moral support and lots of knowledge about e-voting and that kind of stuff. And then there's so many people who can't be here today, people like William Heath, Steph Magdalinsky, James Cronin, Owen Blacker. He's not. He's got the lurgy. Ian Brown, yeah. Also our sort of volunteers, we had a guy called Michael Holloway, who was absolutely essential in helping me with a lot of the donkey work. Glyn Wintle. And we ended up with this group who was really sort of the powerhouse behind the Open Rights Group. So I might have sort of been the person who ended up on TV talking about whatever digital rights issue it was, straight off a flight back from San Francisco and horribly jet-lagged and not entirely knowing what I was talking about. But, you know, you learn to wing that stuff. And in the end, we had an organisation that had crucially popular support. So we had members who were supporting the work. We had conduits into the media. So we became the media go-to voice for digital rights issues, which there really hadn't been a sort of central place for that before. And if they came to us for stuff that we weren't expert in, we would hand them off to the groups that we knew and trusted to be experts in those areas. And we also had people who knew how to lobby. And at the end of the day, what we have 10 years later is an organisation that punches so far beyond its weight, that does so much more than you would expect from its budget and manpower. And that all came from the fact that, you know, there was a real turning point in 2005 where I think everyone just stood up and said, you know, we've really had enough of this and something needs to be done.
Okay, what I want to know is, why was it called the Open Rights Group? Because, and I have a specific reason for asking this, which is that every so often some genius raises his hands, maybe we should change the name, and at which point I start screaming. So I want to hear that there was a really great reason for choosing this name.
The reason that it's called the Open Rights Group, so we had a really significant issue around the name, because all the really good names were already taken, you know, Privacy International and
My Society
and all of that. And it's a bit like naming a band, is you kind of sit there and you kind of go, right, okay, we've got our act here, like we know what we're doing, we know what we want to do, we need a name. And there were a number of meetings.
And Twisted Sister was taken.
That wasn't going to run. We had these meetings, we sat down, and people were trying to come up with names, and we ended up with a list that were all fairly terrible, and the Open Rights Group was the one we all hated the least. And so that's basically what it became, because every time someone who objected to it said, yeah, but, like, the Open, really? What does it even mean? We go, you got a better idea? Silence. Okay, then. So that's how we ended up with the Open Rights Group.
I could add to that, actually, there was a big argument about this name. And there was a faction, which was basically me and Sue and William, and we went off to the country one day and sat on a blanket, and we got all these books out of William's house trying to find names that were better, because we couldn't stand the name. Yeah. And we came up with all these other ideas. And we went back to London. And Danny and everybody, but especially Danny, I think, said, you have no right to rethink the name. You've got no authority. And there was a huge, humongous thing about that. But we've been arguing about the name since 2006, because I've got here my very first Chairs Forward to our very first report, and it does say, not forgetting the all-important and much-discussed, what should we call it? Yeah. So, you know,
if it's any comfort, The Skeptic went through the same thing. I started a magazine years ago called The Skeptic, and and the previous person who had tried to start The Skeptic had foundered on a committee that spent 6 years trying to come up with a name for the newsletter. So I just said, we're calling it the British and Irish Skeptic, and we'll have a competition to come up with a better name. And so I got past them that way. Names are just a horrible, horrible thing.
I actually did a bunch of media interviews even before we had the name. So you'd get into these interviews, and the journalists would be going, so you've started this new digital rights group, so what are digital rights? And you'd explain. And then say, what is the group called?
The Digital Rights Group.
Digital Rights Group. Well, that came
already
later.
Taken.
Already taken. Yes. And in actual fact, in one of those interviews where I floundered trying to answer the question about what's it called without actually, because we at that point didn't have even a suggestion of a name, was the interview where I met my husband. So not only is it 10 years since the Open Rights Group started, it's 10 years since I met my husband.
Shall we say happy anniversary?
I'd also like to point out that that month that we were founded, July 2005, was the London bombings. Mm.
And not too far away from here.
Not too far away from here at all. No, one of the bus that went up. And little did we know at the time that the information and surveillance and privacy and everything information about us agenda was going to be humongously influenced by the events of that summer.
Well, if you look at, you know, it was the next year that they started bringing in identity card legislation again.
Yeah.
And some of the other, RIPA was debated for 5 years at least before it came out. But notice what they learned from it. RIPA was debated for 5 years. Came in because of 9/11, and successively through these later pieces of legislation, less and less public debate has been allowed. I mean, Digital Economy Act was passed there was discussion about DEA, but then at the last minute, all of a sudden, a whole group of MPs changed sides and the thing passed and they went off on vacation, and that taught them the lesson that they could do that, and that's what they did with DRIPA, was it just went, didn't exist, and then a week later it was law.
Wendy, I'm going to have to disagree with you there. The Digital Economy Act was discussed at length for about 5 years.
I said it was actually discussed.
It was rushed through at the end, but the content of it was, you know, basically a massive PR job by the Labour Party to convince everyone that they really knew what the digital economy was. Yeah, fat chance. So when they introduced it, it was kind of their last-ditch attempt to save the Labour government by doing things that were going to increase jobs, because they'd done so well over the few years preceding. The communications data bill, there's a slight error on this slide. It's the Intercept Modernisation Programme, which preceded it, was a Labour plan, I think, around 2006-07.
That's true. I ran out of space.
So that's kind of resurfaced in different forms. I think the issue is that you usually get to debate bits of it, but what they're trying to do is suppress parliamentary time, and suppressing parliamentary time tends to then limit the amount of debate you get in the media and so on. And I think I would also just make the distinction that the DEA happened because of lack of time, essentially. They just ran out of time and they didn't think it was actually very important, actually. They simply didn't think that internet regulation of that nature mattered very much. But the terrorism stuff is simply a Home Office tactic. The Home Office, in my view, don't really understand public engagement. You might say they have a problem with democratic processes. They therefore like to form consensus between the two major party blocks and then be able to limit the amount of debate. They do it. They always press for legislation in emergencies because they know nobody will resist in that moment. So they have a bank of things they want to do and they just wait for an atrocity or some other thing that makes it look like they really need this stuff, then they push it. Now, the Liberal Democrats, I think, show what happens when you don't do that. As soon as you start questioning what's going on, then you get different results. And again, when the Snowden revelations, for better or worse, from the point of view of the Home Office, it's forced debate in all kinds of other areas, David Anderson, even the Intelligence and Security Committee. And the result is they have to actually consider what's going on. And the sort of things they end up proposing might not be entirely to our liking. They're not trying to abolish bulk data retention, but they are saying things like, well, of course the laws have got to be clear. Of course the public have got to have some idea about what's going on. Of course there's got to be oversight mechanisms that work, and possibly we even ought to have judicial authorisation. None of those things would happen if this was a purely Home Office-driven kind of debate. Mm. So, you know, that's the thing. As soon as you insert the public and accountability and democratic accountability, you get a different result. How do you do that? Well, appears you have to have either whistleblowers or coalitions. If you have single-party government, long-term with big fat majorities, then the executive gets an overwhelming power and the Home Office gets to play around. And perhaps that's the root of why they're so out of control. They've had, you know, 70 or 80 years or more of doing surveillance through essentially frightening ministers who can then just press the buttons and get the parties to do what they like.
I do want to pick up on what Louise said, actually, though, about how the nature of the debate changed so dramatically not long after we were founded, because I think originally most of us probably thought we'd be doing quite sort of policy wonkish stuff in Brussels, perhaps, and looking at things like the minutiae of copyright law, about e-voting, data retention. And I don't think anyone of us really expected it all to get so serious and so hardcore with all of the surveillance stuff that suddenly we found ourselves having to deal with. It certainly wasn't on my radar at that time that would happen.
Well, also Privacy International did a lot of that at the time. Mm. And then it's become much more of a research organization, so...
Mm. Well, one thing, the nature of the beast, one thing that kind of material...
I don't know if that's actually on.
Maybe
you might want to check that it is.
Maybe it is. Okay.
Well, it's comforting.
It is comforting. That's speaking to that instead of speaking to the audience. The nature of the beast, how serious things were getting, actually struck me that year, 2005, when we were setting up the organisation, because we were trying to... We had no money. We managed to get £3,000 as seed funding from Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust. We still couldn't take any money from the punters because we had no bank account. We were trying to open a bank account, and a high street bank told us to get lost because we looked like we might be a bunch of terrorists. So, at which point, you know, we were outraged, but also it was like, well, what the hell is going on in the world? Because, you know, we just considered ourselves a bunch of policy wonk type people, really.
I want to just ask, how many of you have things you want to say or ask or comment on?
Name and shame the bank.
Okay.
The biggest bank.
I don't know what the biggest bank is.
The world's biggest bank.
The world's biggest bank.
Possibly.
A bank that at the same time is laundering money to Al-Qaeda.
Wait,
money laundering for Mexican cartel, drug cartels. That bank.
All right. I just wanted to check, because if there were hordes of you with things to say, then we should
take some questions.
You want to ask something sensible? Actually, yeah, I have that too. Yeah, what's the next 10 years? Let's hear it.
From Jim, the executive director.
Yeah, I should kind of say. So I think, I mean, first thing is, as organisations grow, you realise there are more and more things that you really want to do, and you want to get more and more staff hired. A year or so ago, we got a legal director hired because we wanted to start doing legal work. I'd like to see us in the future having staff in Brussels, so we can really track what's going on there and work much better with EDRI, for instance. But, you know, so this is just organisational. I think the big picture is technology gets more important, but also maybe the sorts of technology we have to be considering might also widen. I mean, we don't know what kind of technologies are going to be interesting in 10 years' time. I think that may not just be sort of information technologies. Digital and electronic technology is going to be invested in everything. Everyone's going to have a technology component to their thinking. The question is how much of that comes from org and how much of that comes from other NGOs who simply modernise their thinking. But, I mean, there's no point, for instance, being an NGO worried about car users and not thinking about digital technology, digital rights management, the customisability of your car. So I think this is going to get very, very cross-cutting. I mean, not that we knew that before, but it is going to get, you know, somebody's got to deal with the impact of technology in lots and lots of ways. I'm not sure if org's going to do all of that, but somebody has to do at least some of it, and I expect our remit will widen as a result.
Well, I mean, if you look at John Deere, for example, the tractor people are actually blocking farmers from working on their own equipment. Bill?
Can I ask a question, William?
Go ahead. I was just filling.
So, weren't we originally, aren't we still just a bunch of splitters, like the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front? But it should have been EFF UK right from the start, like I argued 10 years ago, and we'd have had a lot more impact by now if we'd done that.
I'd say we're not the splitters, we're the glue.
EFF is a very different organization. Yeah. I mean, if you watch the original panel, which is up on YouTube, Danny talks about that, and Corey does too, that EFF is a very law-oriented organization. It's full of lawyers. It's constantly trying to write model legislation and intervene in court cases. And I think the feeling was that the judicial structure in this country didn't really lend itself to that. There's a really
simple answer. They don't want to do it. They've taken the choice not to organise outside of the USA, and their understanding of this, and therefore de facto it becomes ours, is that it is better to let organisations grow in their own national context and have their own ways of working rather than imposing that from the USA. And if you think about the ideology and the sort of views that EFF can and do put forward, you know, the sort of very, very hardline US approach to free speech, for instance, that might go down like, you know, a lead balloon in some countries. And for them to have to sort of straddle the various ways of having to explain the same problem would just, you know, give them an enormous communications problem as well as cultural problems. So I think, you know, they've made a sensible choice not to do it, basically.
I think we've also got a different governance framework. We've got a different litigation climate. I mean, from day one, I wanted org to be able to litigate at some point. That was my dream, you know, and you got there, Jim, you know. But we don't have that kind of litigious and do it all through law and by spending trillions on lawyers, climate, here, that
there's,
they do
there's
in
also
the
no class action suits.
No.
Yeah.
So
and
you
judicial
have,
reviews are very hard.
You have to do it in other ways. So it's a very different framework.
And I think the other thing that was very clear from the beginning was that So I was supposed to work part-time, and for the other half of my week, I was supposedly running my own business. And that kind of disintegrated pretty rapidly as it became clear just how much work there was to do, and all sort of took over. What was very clear from the beginning was that there were a lot of other groups in Europe, in the UK, working on very similar issues. And in fact, one of the most viewed images on my Flickr stream even now is a map of all the different organizations that we could potentially create ties to. And so Org was always in a position where we acted in part like an umbrella organization. So the media would come to us, and if they were asking about something that we knew Privacy International knew better than we did, we'd pass them on to them. If it was something European, we'd pass them on to EDRI. We didn't try to own the whole space. We tried to act as the glue that held it together whilst we developed our own particular niche. And I think actually that's worked out really well.
By the same token, when we sort of closed up or rolled up Stand as a campaigning organisation, we took the sort of the digital stuff into the org, and we threw the identity cards or entitlement cards, whichever year we were in, over to Note2ID, and the sort of the campaigning or civic website stuff over to My Society. It's sort of why, well, there are a few of us involved in all three. It was essentially a campaigning organisation that had lots of different things, and we had the ability, because we founded them, to sort of throw things left, right, and centre.
Hmm. Anyone?
I think there was a question there. Someone.
Where?
No, I was just going to suggest that perhaps the EFF looked at the relationship between the FSF and FSF Europe and thought, no, just maybe another reason.
So the FSF is
the.
Well, I mean, there is a separate issue, which is we could have you could have founded Org exactly the same way and done exactly the same things and called it Electronic Frontiers UK. I mean, that's what they did in Australia, where they've been going for 20 years.
We certainly could have stole the name.
You certainly could have used the name.
I'm sure they wouldn't have sued us.
Well, you never know. They're Americans.
No, Danny's not a real American.
Well, Danny is. Ava?
Well, we kind of late arrivals to Org, so maybe we have slightly different perspective because Cybers and Org only joined forces about 2013 during the summer, where the Snowden situation forced a lot of us to be more hands-on. But one thing I think there's a massive opportunity is to be that umbrella in a much stronger way, because there is a lot of people beavering away doing various activities, some more militant than others, which is probably us, some more lawyery than others, but in a way you probably have the best way of collaborating and making that energy go forward in a more impactful way. Because when we had the presentation recently in the House of Commons, the way we got it is because they got scared of our hackers. And you have more hackers than everybody else, but you don't necessarily leverage that. But you have the power and the coalition attitude. So I think there is a massive opportunity to sort of gather everybody together in a more directional way. And I think people respond to it quite well.
Yeah. I agree with that. There's always more that can be done. I think we've spent a lot of time over the last year or two with a quite formal coalition, Don't Spy on Us, which is a few extra affiliates, and I think we can certainly improve the way that that's kind of engaging with a much wider group rather than the sort of six or seven groups that founded it. I completely agree. There's always more, and I mean, I think there'll be a lot of outreach actually from Org over the next year or two. Some of that will be a little bit of diversification. We'll be doing a bit more training for people, trying to get organisations more interested in privacy and security and issues for themselves, partly so that we can get them to understand this is a soluble problem that they have to take responsibility for and they should be thinking about the laws. So we've kind of got a sort of soft approach as well as a sort of harder approach, I think, that will be pushing forward in the future.
So something like the Org Scotland model or similar like that? Do you want to...
I think Org Scotland is another good example of this. I mean, we were unable to do things in Scotland, but they've got some really serious problems. They're introducing a sort of incremental ID card scheme in Scotland. So all the things about the UK ID system, that's to say a centralised database with every citizen on it, with a unique identifier attached to every citizen that then stretches across every single government database in Scotland, attaching all of the data together, plus an ID card, which is optional, which nevertheless gets you in very quickly to your library, bus card or whatever, plus school meals, all that. That's what they have in Scotland. That is literally what they have in Scotland. They're trying to nick the NHS data to enrich it and make it better for user end-user verification and access to data via websites. What exactly is the difference between ID cards, which the SNP opposed, and this plan? I mean, I'm very, very little, actually. So, but we can't run that from London. We can't be opposing that from London alone, not least because it wouldn't really play very well, but also we don't have the contacts, we don't have the time, we can't build a campaign from London. So we've employed somebody in Scotland part-time to be actually able to do this work politically and organisationally. So they're able now to be doing that campaigning, and hopefully that will have an effect. I think Scotland really lacks civil liberties organisations right now. It doesn't have enough of them. And the ones in the UK, including Org, haven't sufficiently devolved to Scotland. I mean, Liberty doesn't have an organisation there, for instance. But there are huge numbers of, most other sectors have. You look at the environmental sector, they've had offices there since the 80s or 90s. But this is not true in the civil liberties. And yet, laws in Scotland touch all of this stuff. They have a centralised police force. A number of New Labour kind of database state things going on. They've also had, they've had numerous problems with police overreach, for instance. So there is a real need for civil liberties organisations there right now.
And what does that apply to Northern Ireland, perhaps?
I'm sure it does. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, one has to do this step by step. Unfortunately, the one thing with Scotland is that we already had two or three active local groups. And so we've now got, three or four local groups that kind of can do things and help. And there's large numbers of people in Org in Edinburgh. At the moment, Northern Ireland, we have very little membership. So that's going to be quite a tough one for us to crack.
One point I'd make there, going back to Bill's point about EFF, was that EFF was never set up or run as a grassroots organisation.
Right.
It was a bunch of lawyers and a few major funders and some, donations that were not from major funders. But it was never designed, and they never wanted it to be a grassroots organisation. And very much Org was all about being a grassroots organisation, pushing the grassroots and the membership.
And I have to say, on that point, it is very easy to underestimate how hard it is to bootstrap any kind of a grassroots organisation. And I say this now having done two, because I am a sucker for punishment, obviously. Open Rights Group, the early years of the Open Rights Group were really hideously hard work, particularly when it came to funding. Because it can be very difficult to get funding to keep the lights on. Your core costs are often not allowed to be included in grant applications. And that's a problem we had with Org in the early days. It's a problem I have with Ada Lovelace Day now, is actually getting enough money together to keep the lights on is incredibly difficult. And I think with Org, if I were doing it again now, having learnt what I've learnt over the last 10 years, I would have put a lot more effort into the funding side of things right from the beginning. As it was, I was a bit sort of, we have these 1,000 people who've pledged £5, we just need to get them all to pay up. In the end, I think not even half of them actually held their pledge and gave us money, and that made life very difficult. So I think it's very easy to look at bootstrapped organisations and say, well, you know, you could do this and you can do that. And I certainly get this with Ada Lovelace Day. Lots of people have suggestions until they also have the money to allow me to pay people to act on those suggestions. Then, you know, you have to just deal with stuff at a scale that you can afford. And that necessarily means that some stuff doesn't get done the way you want it to or just doesn't get done.
That remains true, actually. I mean, it's still true. We're still probably 7 or 8 full-time equivalent members of staff, and there's still lots of things we'd like to do. One thing I would say, though, Sue, is that getting 500 people to pay £5 a month set the organisation up for the long term. So although it made your life harder concentrating that in the short term, it set it up for the long term. And that remains true. People joining is the most valuable kind of funding we have, because it's long term, it's stable, it doesn't come with strings attached. You can do what you like with it politically. You don't have to worry about upsetting people with it. You can just upset them. Right? So it's independence as well as sustainability. Yeah.
So if you want to join, there's a handy link there, and you can join 3,000 people.
We've got a couple of questions.
Yes, I was getting to that.
10 minutes.
So one back there. Hi. You, yes.
So you've gone on multiple times about how you don't have time for things and it's very hard to keep going and things like that, these other things. Adam mentioned that basically when the organisations joined together before war, actually that parts of it got separated off into different sort of concerns. So one society took some stuff, other people took other things, and then all sat down on the things you were involved with. But through all of that, it became much less obvious about what all was doing. And in terms of volunteering, much less obvious about how you can volunteer and what you're volunteering for. In some organisations, very hard to volunteer at all. And to this day, it's like org is not particularly good at recruiting people and using people's time. And I would be willing to wager that probably half the people in this room would quite happily give some time to org.
You used to have quite a good volunteers
mailing list.
The mailing list is one thing. Actually, having a volunteer manager and coordinating things and having
to be fair, particularly in the early days, we did have a lot of really core volunteers who did a lot of very hard work, particularly around things like the Leveson report. But volunteering, and again, I'm still seeing this today with stuff like Ada Lovelace Day, volunteers do need managing. And when you are trying to bootstrap any organisation, you have all the funding concerns on one side. You have to get the money in to pay for the keeping the lights on. You've got all the campaigning stuff that you have to do. You've got all the media stuff that you have to do. And then you have the volunteers that you have to manage. And managing volunteers is actually a lot of work. And I think it's very easy to underestimate just how much time and effort that takes. And that's not to say that we don't appreciate the very, very important hard work that volunteers do, but volunteers are not always the answer. And I'm actually pulling back from the viewpoint that we can solve everything through volunteers.
I'm not saying you can solve everything through volunteers, it's just that you can get a lot of work done.
So I think, I think we agree with that. And I think I kind of heard Ruth's point. Voice there, who probably wants to say something on this, but just before I do, just before Ruth does, I'll just really, really quickly say, you know, you think about what we launched with the block.org.uk site, which checks for blocks, you know, what website's been blocked by what company. That was entirely built by volunteers.
I know, I track this quite carefully as well. I mean, I know what's going on with these things, but it's not easy enough for these things.
No,
so and those projects are, you're not sure of developers, you're not sure of people who
and still it was very, very hard to get people doing that. It was a huge amount of effort to get people in and concentrated on it. So and of course people tend to think, well, if so, you know, there are lots of things that happen there, but I mean there's that, there's also our volunteer lawyers group, and of course all the local groups that are now functioning in different places and helping us. So I think you're right that it is hard and it takes a lot of work. I think we're doing a lot of that work, but and it's not always I think the thing with developers and trying to leverage developers is we need to have very concrete, good ideas for things that will be effective. So the first step in that is if you've got a really good idea for something that org can do, let us know. Because if we've got those ideas and you know they really, really help our campaign goals that are going to inspire other people to get involved, then we do have people like our project manager who can then pull that forward. So help us with the ideas, and we'll help you to do the work. Ruth, do you want to say something?
You said lots of things I was going to say. I was going to mention that the block project has got one volunteer, which sounds like you already know. I was going to say, we do have our own groups for nature reserve staff. Sorry, hi, I'm Ruth. So we do have someone who manages...
Ruth, maybe stand up so people can hear you better.
Hi. Yeah. We do have local groups around the country, and we do have someone now who manages those and coordinates events, and we're doing like so much more stuff with groups that's really good. And just in the last couple of months, we've started like moving towards handing over like our London groups to volunteers so that they can lead and like organise campaigning themselves, and we did a campaigning workshop. We got them to come up with lots of ideas of things they could do. We're trying to like do a lot more kind of like encourage people to take a leadership role in it. But I think that's the thing that Jim was saying. Like a lot of it is it's people coming to us and not just saying like I'd like to volunteer, but having a bit more of like I'd like to volunteer and I'm really good at campaigning and I've got this idea. And then it's really helpful because you can be like, oh great, well that's what one thing you can work on. But an open call to volunteer is often quite hard to sort of go like, right, well what project could that work with?
But so the difference between maintaining a list of people who are available who have those skills you can call later and going out and doing what you need it.
Yeah. So, well,
but even if you have a list, you don't always get the response and the skills that you need. I had a list of 65 people who volunteered for Ada Lovelace Day, and I would kind of say to that list, you know, this is a very specific task that I need doing, and end up with nothing. You know, I have volunteer. I have a section on our forum saying these are very quick, easy things that you can do. This is a 5-minute task, and it's important. And if you do it, it will be really great. And here is exactly what I'd like you to do. And people don't do it.
That stuff is like, yeah, on the internet, if you're just posting it randomly, it doesn't work.
No, this is all about. This is. I agree. This is all about human contact ultimately. And if you're saying, if you're sort of sitting here and saying, I'd really like to get involved, fantastic. Okay, so I mean, so it's good feedback to know perhaps it doesn't always work for people, and I think that's why we're investing the time and energy in trying to develop that. If specifically somebody here wants to volunteer and has got some ideas or maybe doesn't have ideas, just talk to us afterwards and we'll see what we can do. I mean, it is about, I think a lot of it is about that human contact, knowing people, and then each side trusting that their work is going to be valued and having something just put it, you know, specific to do.
Okay, moving on. You had your hand up.
Yes,
the star on your chest.
One small point on that, which is that some people who are, in a sense, volunteers do actually want to be in the position of waiting to be asked. So I'm very happy to help org with something they come and think I would be particularly good at, but my life is full of a bunch of other things, and I'm not going to go out there and search for extra ways to use my time. But if my so
okay.
There are some people okay in that position.
Okay.
But my question was, do you know how many of the 500 people who originally started paying £5 a month are still paying?
Not off the top of my head, but I would imagine it's most. I mean, we have very few people who are paying standing orders leaving. People who leave boringly use PayPal. It is, if you ever set up an organisation based with, you know, on using regular payments, avoid PayPal because it cancels people's subscriptions once their cards go out of date. Their cards go out of date, maximum 3 years notice, which means a third of your members drop off every year. So don't do it.
Good point.
What's the alternative?
Well, these days, use direct debit, go cardless, something like that.
So I had a two-part question, which is essentially, one, who in this room is one of the founding 1,000? And secondly, who is a member of Org and is it here? Who's a member?
What's the difference? You pay £5 a month to a member.
So who's a founding?
But who was a founding member was his first question.
Who was persuaded by their rhetoric on day one?
Yes.
Or indeed, who's an Endkämpfer?
Anyone else? There's a gentleman at the back there.
It sounds like some of this discussion is about whether Org is an organisation that does things on behalf of people, experts, or whether it's an organisation that facilitates people to do stuff for themselves. And so I take the point about managing volunteers and stuff. But there's one way through my about 38 degrees where they can people for
Ian?
I got two questions as well. They're really quick.
This isn't that cheating.
So, seeing how payments, kind of regular payments, are really important, what are you doing to drive that? And secondly, we're here 10 years later. I want to get your opinions about what we'll be doing in the next 10 years.
So on the direct debit or on the regular payments, we do a huge amount, and I mean, the basic model is that we get people involved with signing petitions, emailing their MP, following us on Twitter. We get public engagement in the campaigns. We get people to read our emails, read about our campaigns, understand not just the issues but how we're tackling them, and then we ask them to join. And that works incredibly well. I think it took a long time for us to get more than 1,500 members. We had a huge boost around the Digital Economy Act, and then the politicians stopped doing really bad things for a while, a couple of years, and we plateaued a bit. Actually, for two odd years, about 2010 to 2012, people were kind of we didn't have things to be angry about. Not too many. But then it escalated.
2010 was the DEA.
No, well, that I mean, after the election.
Okay, you need to talk faster because we're running out of time.
Okay, well, I'm always told not to. So the key thing is we have, in the last 18 months, we've moved from about 1,600 members to over 3,000. That's taken a little less than 2 years. And there is really one reason for that, and that is Edward Snowden and more surveillance on top of what he told us about. People are angry about it and they want to help. And we help them to help financially. I hope we also help them to engage politically and to do things that affect their elected representatives. The 10-year question, I think we've touched on some of it, but I think obviously surveillance is going to be a huge part of this for the next few years. We've got data proliferation going on everywhere. Either there has to be a sea change in attitudes or we're going to end up in a really bad place.
Dan's blog posting about that panel mentions a nanotechnology giant robot research project, and I'd like to hear about progress on that. How much time do we have, Adam?
We've got about 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Two minutes. What is the next demon technology that will make headlines in the Daily Mail?
Know your audience.
Autonomous vehicles? I don't know.
I was just going to say self-driving cars. Yeah.
I asked this at the Web We Want festival, and somebody said kids with having secret computers under the mattresses in their.
Already have that?
They're not secret though. Everybody knows they have the phones. It's secret computers. What was the other one? There was one other really good one from that. Anyone else, real quick, with a really fast question? All right.
What about self-manufacturing drugs? Children's chemistry.
My contribution was 3D kids taking 3D printed their parents 3D printed sex toys to school. You know.
That manufactured drugs.
In the devices.
I think 3D printing really is going to be a big thing, I think, for the Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. But I think for us, I think the bigger thing is going to be the Internet of Things, which is going to be a massive disaster. You had something.
Well, I was just about to say that one of the problems we've got at the moment is that this sweeping surveillance and things. And I think one of the problems we have at the moment is people don't use things like encryption. And if you perhaps came up with one of the things that I was hearing a lot about was this robust social graph that the authorities are collecting, perhaps we need a kind of a system where we could rewrite emails so that it actually sends emails to 5 random people. They send an email to 5 random people, eventually it gets to the person that he actually sent the email.
I love the idea of institutionalized email sent to the wrong people. I think that's such a wonderful idea. We're going to have to close up. But thank you all so much for coming. Thank you to our panelists and to our founders. And hopefully we'll see you again in 10 years.
Please. if you haven't joined already, please do. It is vital to our work. Yes. And if you do want to join, Ruth will help you on the stall later today.